These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
Support for the Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. Authorities say they have their man, who's already dead, in four cold case murders that date back to the 1980s. President Trump pledges a national investigation of voter fraud as lawmakers here consider a pile of bills to change voting laws. Governor Sununu's first act as governor, a pause on executive branch rulemaking, is dismissed by the legislature. And the head of New Hampshire's beleaguered Department of Children, Youth, and Family says she's retiring to spend more time with the family, a decision that followed a tough outside report on operations there. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers, joined this week by Trent Spinner, New Hampshire Union leader, Kathleen Ronayne, Associated Press, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Good morning, all. Let's start with the announcement yesterday on the 30-year-old cold cases. Anyone who's seen the local headlines knows this is rather lurid. A serial killer's twisted path is one from your paper, Trent. Another is how many more victims? What do you think people ought to know about this case, Trent?
That it's shocking. What authorities are saying is that Bob Evans, which may not be his real name, murdered potentially six people, if not more, including four people who were found in barrels in Bear Brook State Park in Allenstown, which was a mystery for about 30 years. You may remember that the FBI was searching a Manchester home for 3 days. The authorities yesterday said that all of these things are connected. It's shocking. It's something that we haven't seen in New Hampshire, and I think there's a lot more to go. The authorities think that he may have used four other names, that there may be other people who were murdered, including one of the girls who was found in one of these barrels. They are concerned about her mother. They don't know where she is. So I think there's a lot more to go here.
Why don't we take a listen to what Assistant Attorney General Jeff Strelzin had to say at the press conference yesterday.
We're confident that Bob Evans is the person who killed the four victims in Allenstown. We have concerns about the mother of that middle child and believe she may be dead as well. And we believe that he killed Denise Bowden somewhere between New Hampshire and California. We believe that Bob Evans likely killed all those people and that his killing finally came to an end in California in 2002 with his last victim, Yoon Sun Jun.
All right, that was Jeff Strelzin, the top prosecutor on this investigation, talking about Bob Evans. As you say, Trent, we don't really know if that's actually his name. And what do we know about his time in New Hampshire? That at one point he was head electrician at the Wambeck Mills.
Yeah, we don't know all that much about his time in New Hampshire. He was here. He had been arrested a few times on minor things like stealing electricity. And he gave a couple of different names. We don't really know. He did work at the Wambeck Mills as an electrician. We think that what we've heard is that the property in Bear Brook State Park is adjacent to his boss who at Wambeck. But you know, this was back in the 70s and the 80s, and so authorities are really asking people to take a look at his different mugshots. We actually have all the different versions of his mugshot on the front page of today's Union Leader. And they're asking to take a look at these pictures to see if you knew him, if you remember him, and if you can give authorities some information. If you listen to Jeff Strelzin, he said, look, this person could have been murdered anywhere between New Hampshire and California. I mean, that's a pretty big place. And they were looking for her body in the basement of this home in Manchester. They did not find her there. So they're still searching.
I mean, at various points in the press conference, Jeff Strelzin referred to Bob Evans as a chameleon, being careful and methodical, and that said that people didn't know anything about him. Kathleen.
And I think what's also really interesting about this case is we still don't know the identities of these four bodies that were found in Allenstown. I think the first few were found in the 80s or 90s, and then the two others were found, I think, in 2000. And it's a woman and three young girls. And they've never been able to identify who this woman and these girls are. And they still have not been able to do that. I think it was last year that they released these new composite sketches. You know, the cold case unit in the state is still trying to figure out who they are. So now that they have identified that one of those girls is, you know, shares DNA, Bob Evans is her father, that might also go towards figuring out who these women are. And they know that the woman and the two other girls were related, but there was this third child. And maybe there will be a link there. Maybe people will come forward and have a little bit more information.
And in fact, the now adult daughter of Denise Beaudin, who I think has three kids of her own, has released a letter saying to focus on trying to identify these other individuals. And this is the kind of thing where as more information is known, it will jar, as Trent was suggesting, it will jar people's memories. People may start to remember things. It's also a testament to the impact of DNA analysis and the way in which that technology has created a whole new way of revisiting a lot of these cold cases.
Well, in terms of what actually kind of re-energized this investigation, I mean, was it this contact from the San Bernardino Sheriff's Department? I guess this was last year, and it was unclear to me from reading the coverage. I wasn't at the press conference. What prompted that? Do you know, Trent?
That's a good question. The thing to keep in mind is that this really started back in the 70s. And Denise Beaudin, when she goes missing in the early 80s, no one reports her missing. The two of the bodies are found in Allenstown in 1985, 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago. And nothing really happens between 85 and 2000 when the bodies are found again. So there's a 15-year lapse. The other thing that made this case incredibly difficult was nobody reported anyone missing. So you have Denise Beaudin, you have a woman and three children found in barrels in a state park, and no one reported them missing. We still don't know who these people are. And when they did that, they did isotope testing on these bodies. And what they were able to determine was that these people were local. The people who were found murdered had isotopes in that are found in New Hampshire. So they believe that at least some of them were from the area, but still no one has reported them missing, despite the sketches, despite all the publicity. And so that's been a really big challenge for police, because what Jeff Strelzin said yesterday was that the victim, understanding who the victim is what really leads them to the murder. And they don't have that very first step.
And I think also, I mean, at least in the case of Denise Beaudin, I mean, that was maybe a couple months ago, right, where they said that they were opening this missing persons case for the first time. I wasn't at the presser, but just based on what I've read, it sounds like, so Bob Evans, I think he had been in jail for abandoning the little girl at some point in the 90s and got out on parole and kind of was on the run. And then from what our AP story says, it's when he died in prison in California, they were still trying to figure out, you know, what his relationship was to this, you know, now woman. And they did some DNA testing and they found out that she had family in New Hampshire. And that led them to figure out that her mom was Denise Beaudin. So maybe she didn't know who her mother was before that, which kind of sparked them re-looking into this case and deciding to label her as a missing person. So, I mean, it sounds like it's kind of a confluence of all kinds of absolutely crazy factors that put this all together. And I think it sounds like it's right out of like an episode of Criminal Minds or something like that. It's absolutely crazy, I think, to, you know, link all of these murders across the country and things that are still unsolved. And, you know, there's a lot more we don't know here.
And just to be clear, he was in the California prison for killing what appears to be his common-law wife or his then-girlfriend, a woman named Yusun Jun, who was found, you know, dismembered under a pile of cat litter. I mean, this is lurid stuff. But we're going to move on at this point, and we're going to move to politics. President Trump could sign an order today to initiate what he describes as a major investigation into voter fraud, including people registered to vote in two states, those who are legal and those who are dead but may still appear on voting rolls. And, you know, there seems to be some irony in his first area of concern, the two-state residents, regarding, you know, people very close to him. Isn't that true, Dean?
Yeah, it's been reported that his own daughter, Tiffany, is registered in multiple states. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner,
His press secretary.
A couple of his press secretaries, Sean Spicer, Bannon, his advisor. I mean, the reality is this is not that unusual for people to register in one state and then kind of move on somewhere else. And sometimes the registration doesn't get cleared off of the old rolls for a while, if at all. I mean, this is kind of blown up into something I think congressional Republicans would probably rather not have to deal with. It continues to come from President Trump's repeated statements that if 3 to 5 million people who were here illegally had not voted for Hillary Clinton, he would have won the popular vote as well. So, you know, he started out with a very specific statement about people who are here illegally voting, and now it's become a whole much bigger thing about, you know, people who are deceased but who are on voter rolls and people who are registered in multiple states. And he has said he's going to sign an executive order looking into all of this, and his Vice President Mike Pence has been very supportive of that. He was supposed to sign it yesterday. He has not yet done that. It's now being said he'll do it on Saturday.
You're the sort of scholar among us, Dean. In terms of the differentiation between state and federal power over looking at voting rolls in individual states, you know, there are those who would say that this is not something that the federal government
would not be doing in
states.
Yeah, I mean, there are sort of some federal laws about, you know, assuring your ability to vote, but typically this kind of stuff takes place at the state level, and, you know, a number of states have looked into various complaints. It typically is a handful, at most in the tens or hundreds, and you don't see a lot of widespread fraud. Certainly not the idea that that, you know, we often hear the figure 10 to 12 million people here in the country illegally. The idea that 3 to 5 million of those folks voted for Hillary Clinton, this is a very hard thing to comprehend. So there's been a lot of pushback on this. President Trump seems adamant to move forward on it. And, you know, this voter fraud discussion is something we seem to be having every 2 to 4 years, depending on the election cycle. And there's just not a lot of evidence of it taking place at the scale that he is suggesting.
Well, and I think there's also, I mean, what do we mean when we're talking about fraud, right? Just because someone's registered to vote in two states doesn't mean that they did, in fact, register to vote in two states. Just because a dead person is still on the voter rolls does not mean that someone is showing up and using their name to actively engage. So I think there's a lot of ambiguity here over what the president is looking for, what he considers to be voter
fraud.
But he's
changing his focus, right?
Well, right.
The initial statement was that 3 to 5 million people here illegally in the country voted for Hillary Clinton.
Right.
He's
now
changing it to this sort of, well, dead people and people who are registered in two states. That's a different issue.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if I don't know what the ultimate goal here is. Is it to find out how many people are registered in two states and to consider that number your fraud number? Is it to find out how many people actually voted when they shouldn't be voting? Is that how you calculate your fraud number? And there's just, again, you know, no evidence to support these claims. And he also hasn't answered the question of who is going to pay for this. I mean, what does this operation look like? And is this taxpayer money? I mean, you would think that it is going to be taxpayer money if we're having states, you know, engage in these massive operations to determine whether or not there's voter fraud. When many states, I think it was the Ohio Secretary of State came out and said, we looked at this a couple years ago and we have found nothing. We've already done this. You know, we don't want to be doing this again. So lots of unanswered questions here that executive order could potentially answer or not.
It's been a parade of secretaries of state on cable news over the last few days. All of them
very
saying,
"Very exciting group of people."
Well, you meet a whole new group of people in the political process, and all of them to an individual say, "Yeah, we investigate some, but we've never found anything on the scale of what the president is suggesting."
I was concerned when I started hearing all of this discussion that maybe I was breaking the law because I lived in Ringe and I voted there in 2004. Excuse me. Then I lived in Manchester and I voted there in 2008 and 2012. And now I live in Concord and I'm registered to vote there. But I never did anything about my voter registration in Ringe or my voter registration in Manchester. And so I was concerned, am I doing something illegal? And so I researched the law and I determined that I'm actually not. I am registered to vote in more than one place. But unless I actually go and vote on the same day in multiple places, I'm not committing a crime. And so I said, how many people really do this in New Hampshire? And I looked it up. I look back at our coverage back in 2014. It turns out we charged one person. One person who was a Massachusetts resident, it was a man named Lauren Schneider, pleaded guilty to a felony charge. He was in his mid-60s. He lives in Carver, Massachusetts, and he felt like his vote didn't count in Massachusetts. He was a Democrat. We wrote about this at the time in 2014. He's a Democrat. He said, my vote doesn't count in Massachusetts. There are so many Democrats here. I want to go up to New Hampshire. People, he came up, drove up to Manchester. Even though he's registered to vote in Carver, Massachusetts, he registered to vote in Manchester, and he broke the law. He was charged with, he was investigated. Somebody at the polling place recognized him, realized that he didn't live there. He was allowed to vote, but the AG's office eventually went in and they investigated him. They charged him with a felony. He pleaded guilty. He got a 1 to 3 year state prison sentence, which was suspended, but he's no longer allowed to vote in New Hampshire because of this.
All right, we have an email from Rob. He says, am I the only one who finds it comical that it was the media who demanded Trump provide proof of his allegation that illegals voted for Clinton, but the minute he called their bluff and ordered an investigation, the same media went 180 and said we shouldn't waste taxpayer money on such an investigation? Pretty obvious to me. They're afraid of what we'll find. So says Rob, tell us what you think. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Kathleen?
I would just say to Rob's point that I think, the president's initial statement was not, I'd like to see if 3 to 5 million people voted illegally and I'd like to investigate that. It was, I would have won if 3 to 5 million people did not vote illegally. So making a factual statement without facts to back it up, I think, is the difference here and why people were kind of calling him at the beginning when he was making that statement. He wasn't saying it might have happened and I'd like to look into it. He was saying it did happen without being able to show that it in fact did.
Now, this discussion more broadly coming from the president and just sort of broadly in politics right now about purity of election, is something that is really churning at the State House. I mean, I don't know, there are 40-ish bills regarding this at the State House. Most are aimed at tightening the law, and some were before committees this week. One would force voters who present out-of-state IDs to have their information added to a statewide voter database. There was another that would give the Secretary of State's office broader powers to investigate issues around voting. Do you have any sense, Kathleen, where these debates are headed? I mean, is there going to be a real winnowing of these bills down to a proposal or two ultimately?
I would think so. I mean, Dave Solomon had reported in the Union Leader that Republican leadership, I think, was trying to get together and maybe figure out what was the best path forward for some of these bills because there are so many that are coming up. And I think, you know, I think the things that we're really probably going to be focusing on are whether or not we need to tighten up, you know, what is acceptable ID when you come to the polls. Like, there's another bill that makes it clear that an expired student ID does not count as a valid form of identification. I haven't talked to the sponsor, but I would assume it's a worry that maybe you've graduated and, you know, no longer actually live here and still use your student ID. So I think we're probably going to the focus will probably be on, you know, tightening up what you have to show at the polls, as well as, the question of residency and domicile. I think, that's been a big debate here. We know that the Republican legislature has passed residency bills before. And for anyone who doesn't understand the difference, you could have your car registered in another state, but you could still consider New Hampshire, you know, your domicile if this is where you are for the period of time and plan to be here, in the near future. Republicans want to make that a little stricter and say, you know, for 10 to 30 days prior to the election, you actually have to be a resident of New Hampshire, which comes along with new
fights about the durational requirement. And, you know, right now the sort of like quickest way to understand is that, the state's been considered sort of domicile as more a state of mind and an intention to be someplace, but an intention that doesn't have any hard time limit to it. And that's something Republicans have been concerned about for some time.
Yeah. And we've seen this. I think that the Ballot Law Commission tends to be fairly flexible in how they interpret domicile. So, Republicans would like to tighten that up.
All right. Coming up, more of the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange in just a moment. Stick around.
This is NHPR's 919. Good morning. NHPR's news site has won national recognition for coverage of local news, politics, and feature stories from around the state. Make it your essential source for what you need to know every day. Bookmark it now and add it to your list of essential news sources at nhpr.org. Mix of sun and clouds for most of New Hampshire today. Mostly cloudy with some snow likely from the mountains north. Windy statewide. High temperatures lower 30s. Northern New Hampshire ranging lower 40s in the south. It'll be clouding up tonight and windy. Some snow likely in northern Coos County. Lows tonight from upper teens, north country ranging upper 20s in southern New Hampshire. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Doucette Survey, professional land surveyors providing services throughout New England with offices in Bedford, Newmarket, and Kennebunk, Maine. DOUCETSurvey.com. This is NHPR.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or find us at NHPR Exchange on Twitter or Facebook. Joined this week by Dean Spiliota, Southern New Hampshire University, Kathleen Ronan, Associated Press, and Trent Spinner, New Hampshire union leader. We're going to stick with voting for a few more minutes. I just want to play a little bit of tape of what Governor Sununu recently said. Recall that shortly after he won election, he said that he wanted to revisit New Hampshire's policy of same-day voter registration.
We've put together a group that is working with the House and the Senate in terms of all the different variables that come into play. I'm not sure exactly what that final bill might look like. There is no doubt, I think pretty much everyone can agree, we do need to tighten the laws up, you know, in terms of what is defined as domiciled and residency. You know, whether we go to, you know, moving to more to motor voter or we keep same-day registration, provisional balloting, you know, how it's going to be enforced. All those are aspects of what could come into the bill. We've looked at it very closely, and I'm confident that whatever comes out is going to be a much better solution and a long-term solution for the state of New Hampshire.
All right, that was Governor Chris Sununu. As you heard, not a great deal of clarity there about what we're going to get. This was something that he sort of brought upon himself shortly after the election, calling for a revisitation of same-day voter registration. There, he's speaking more generally about a Republican bill. So he seems to be talking about it in terms of a single policy, Dean.
Yeah, and I think there's certainly agreement among Republicans that these laws need to be tightened, and so you may very well see something from the caucus and with a Republican governor. It's the likelihood of it becoming law is greater, but you know we've been down this road before. Democrats consider a lot of this stuff voter suppression. It will end up in court, as it often does. And so this sort of issue of voter fraud and does it really exist and, you know, what are kind of reasonable expectations in terms of what you need to prove your right to vote in the state. We're going to continue to debate this. As I said, you know, Republican legislature and Republican governor, we're more likely to see some movement on it. But, you know, Democrats will push back, you know, in the end, likely through the courts.
And we have a flurry of communications on this front from listeners. Dennis says the president completely fabricates a story about millions of fraudulent voters, legislators, and legitimize a claim by advancing laws to restrict voting rights. Fake news driving legislation. Is this any way to formulate public policy? That's Dennis of Barrington. A tweet from Sue says there's essentially no voter fraud except for the mind of the GOP. Stop voter suppression efforts. And caller Melody says we shouldn't focus on voter fraud. It's a non-issue. So that's what some people are telling us.
Well, let's look at the facts. How many people in New Hampshire does this affect? And the secretary, currently, New Hampshire law says that if you go to the polls and you don't have an ID, that you have to sign an affidavit saying that you live in New Hampshire and swear under penalty of perjury that you are domiciled here. The Secretary of State's office collected all of those affidavits for the 2016 election. So everyone who came to the polls without an ID, it was 1,423 people, 1,423 people. So what's happening right now is that letters are going out to all of these people, and they have to return the letter saying, yes, I live here. So in terms of the numbers, there were some close elections in 2016, but we're talking about 1,423 people who did not have IDs at the polling places in New Hampshire in 2016.
All right. We have one more email, and this is from Brad Cook, who's chairman of the Ballot Law Commission, who says he was somewhat taken aback by the comment, and I think this was you, Kathleen, that the Ballot Law Commission has been somewhat flexible on domicile. Chairman Cook wants to know, if you have any examples of improper flexibility at the Ballot Law Commission.
No, I think so. When I was thinking, when I was thinking of that, I was thinking about Walt Havenstein in 2014, the candidate for governor went before the Ballot Law Commission, and maybe flexible was not maybe the right word. But what I was going to explain with that is there was this whole question. I can't remember the specifics, but he had a home in another state that was in New Hampshire within the past 7 years, which is the
deadline. And there was a question about,
whether or not, you know, since he had a home in New Hampshire as well as somewhere else where he was going for work, you know, could he in fact consider New Hampshire his domicile? And Democrats really pushed back that he could not. And the Ballot Law Commission, you know, ruled that, you know, he considered it his domicile and then that was allowed. So by using the word flexible, I was not meaning to suggest that the Ballot Law Commission had made improper decisions. That's not really my decision to make. But this is something that has come up, and they have, you know, there have been situations where someone does have property in two places, and
I mean they have tended to lean more towards allowing people to participate who
right,
have a viable claim.
And I think that's
residence.
what I was getting at with that comment.
Okay, obviously we could get in the muck of domicile for a long time. There'll be plenty of that to go at the State House this year. But why don't we turn to some other issues that were up for debate this week? And one was a big bit of backtracking on a bill that got a lot of attention of the non-positive sort recently, and that was a bill that would require testimony of victims to be corroborated in first offense sexual assault cases, which would be most sexual assault cases. The sponsors have basically tried to pull the plug on that, Bill Trent. What's the backstory with that piece of legislation?
The backstory is that there's a local doctor who was treating a child, and the child has made an allegation that the doctor sexually assaulted him, and the doctor is now facing felony sexual assault charges. And here's where it gets here's where sort of the twist comes in, is that all these other people, including doctors and well-respected members of the community around in and around Concord, know the doctor, and they say there is no way that he did this. And so they went to a few state reps who said we should change the law so that there needs to be evidence. There needs to be physical evidence backing up a victim's testimony for someone to be charged with sexual – to be convicted of sexual assault. Victims advocates say that this is a terrible idea, that this would create – a different burden for these kinds of cases compared to any other criminal case. So it's been I think there have been a lot of very fiery opinions on both sides of the issue.
I mean, when your bill becomes known as the Pedophile Protection Act, it's probably not going to make it through the legislature.
Yeah, I mean, I think just quickly to Trent's point, you know, the bill did not specifically say physical evidence. It broadly said a victim has to be able to corroborate their testimony for prosecution. There was no definition of what corroboration means. The sponsor got up there and said, well, it could be a witness. It could be DNA. It could be a notable change in the child's behavior. But none of this was spelled out. And part of the issue here with this is, you know, until maybe the 1970s or so, you know, a lot of states did require a higher standard for bringing forth sexual assault cases. And in the 1970s, there was kind of a national move sort of away from that. And our statute specifically says, you know, corroboration is not required, where if you look in, you know, most of our other criminal code, whether it's like you know, battery laws or something like that, corroboration is not mentioned one way or the other. And I think that there was also some, you know, it seemed like a little bit of confusion in the hearing that, you know, prosecutors may just be, you know, a child might just say that they were sexually assaulted and this person just goes away forever. But, you know, this still is something that goes through the court system. Police and prosecutors were coming up and saying, you know, anytime we're bringing a charge, we're looking for evidence and things that we have to back it up. But especially in child sexual assault cases where people come forward years later, you know, certainly a witness or DNA evidence or something else like that doesn't exist. And basically saying that this would, you know, might prevent people from coming forward, not to mention setting up a totally double standard of, you know, if the person who sexually assaults you has been convicted before, then it's easier for you to bring a case than if they haven't. So I think that the sponsors kind of saw the writing on the wall on this one.
I mean, this will still have to hit the floor, but it's not going to get much of a debate and will go away.
I doubt it. I mean, even, you know, in our legislature, I think the domestic violence advocates are, you know, they're very effective. And I think Republicans and Democrats on both sides of the aisle, you know, really listen to I think they're very sensitive to these issues. And I don't see this bill going anywhere.
Well, another bill on which they've been active and which is moving seemingly fast in another direction are actually two proposals. One's in the Senate, one's in the House. It would ensure New Hampshire's rape shield law applies essentially throughout a case's transit through the judicial system. The debate obviously springs from the Seth Mazalia appeal in the murder of former UNH student Lizzie Marriott. What was at issue there, Trent?
The issue there is that there was some argument. Seth Mazalia's defense team, his appeal team, was arguing that his victim's past sexual history should have been admitted at trial. During the trial, the trial judge said, no, we're not going to admit that. There are laws against that. And so Mazalia went to the Supreme Court asking that that evidence be admitted, even though he's already been found guilty. He says that he should get a new trial, get a new chance here. And there was some discussion and it sounded like the Supreme Court was moving towards at least allowing testimony about some of that information. So some of that information would have come out in public, and the family and the domestic violence advocates were obviously very concerned about that. So what the legislature is trying to do is really to make that a formal, you know, law that even though there are some laws on the books, trying to make sure that case, that something like that doesn't happen again.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, and I might not have this exactly correct, but the rape shield law as it applies now is you can't bring that type of testimony about a victim's past sexual history in trial, but it did not specifically apply to appeal. And so what was happening is in the appeals process, Mazalia was trying to get this in.
There have been a rules change.
Right. And so the whole issue is whether or not, you know, this kind of applies over the whole life of a case versus, you know, whether it can be allowed in the appeal but not in the initial trial. I'm pretty sure that's what the debate is kind of centering on.
All of these bills, victims advocates have pushed back very hard, the concern being that it will, prior sexual history is admissible, if you have to have corroborating evidence of a claim of sexual assault, that it's gonna inhibit people from coming forward when they otherwise might if they've been sexually assaulted. So you've seen a big pushback from that community of professionals.
Their argument is if you murder somebody, why does it matter what they did in their sexual life before you did that?
All right. Tell us what you think. Push back if need be. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Another issue that had several proposals before the legislature this week is, you know, medical marijuana. That's something that, there are bills looking to widening the number of qualifying conditions to include, among others, chronic pain, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and opioid addiction. My understanding is marijuana as an opioid treatment, New Hampshire's law would be novel in that respect, less so with the others.
I don't know that there are any other states that, you know, specifically allow medical marijuana as a treatment for opioid addiction. There is certainly anecdotal evidence of people saying that it is an effective treatment, but the science on this is just still really not determined. And you had people, some doctors up testifying on that fact, saying that there just hasn't been enough research and evidence to prove that this is in fact an effective treatment. On the other side, there were some people testifying. There was one man from, I think, North Conway who got up and was talking about how he has a back injury and he does qualify under the law for medical marijuana, but that before the law went into effect, he was using opioids for his pain. And he didn't say that he was addicted or anything like that, but said that the switch to marijuana once the law went into effect was really life-changing and didn't have the same side effects. And so part of the argument more broadly on extending medical marijuana to things like chronic pain or PTSD is that some people are arguing that it may be easier, you know, to get an opioid. You can get an opioid that is highly addictive prescribed to treat chronic pain. But if you have chronic pain alone, you can't get medical marijuana. And people are saying, you know, given the crisis that we're in, they believe marijuana works better for them and is less addictive.
It's interesting. You know, we've had this medical marijuana was approved, I think, about 3 years ago. It's only really gotten up and running in the past.
You have 2,000 patients who
use it in the state. So it's fairly new in terms of actually having it function. But I remember back with the debate 3-4 years ago, PTSD was one of the conditions that was excluded, and there was an outcry at that point from the veterans community and people dealing with PTSD. Opioids was not one of the big things discussed back then. It's interesting what a difference 3 years has made.
Well, PTSD, that was something that Governor Hassan was particularly clear that she would not accept a bill that included that. And, you know, the argument from some people in the therapeutic community was that allowing people with PTSD just to use medical marijuana might make them less useful, might make them less likely to attend therapy sessions, and that was, in fact, the more...
And attitudes on marijuana use are changing so rapidly in the country over the last 2 or 3 years that it just feels like we're at a different place now than we were 4 years ago when this was being debated. And there was, a lot of focus by the governor to really make this a narrow set of conditions that qualify. You go other states, medical marijuana, you much broader range of conditions that are covered. I think we'll probably move in that direction. The issue of using marijuana to treat opioids, that's a little more of a recent discussion, and that's going to probably provoke some opposition. But I think in general, we're moving towards a liberalization of who can get access to it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there are 28 states where medical marijuana is permitted, and I think I did a quick count. I think 10 permit it to be prescribed for PTSD, for what that's worth. But as you say, this discussion is changing. I mean, one marijuana discussion that was of a kind of a more retro sort was a colorful story you had in your paper this week, Trent, about marijuana of the non-medical support sort and a Burger King in Epping and a fellow known as Nasty Boy. Could you take it from here?
The Burger King in Epping allegedly was selling marijuana. The Burger King itself wasn't selling it. There was a gentleman who went by the name Nasty Boy, and so you would pull up to the window. You would say, "Is Nasty Boy working?" And if they said yes, you could order an order of fries extra crispy, and that would come with that. Your order would come with some marijuana stuffed at the bottom of a coffee cup. Police had heard about some drug sales happening at this Burger King, but thought it was all happening in the parking lot. They finally did a sting, and they arrested two individuals who worked there, an assistant manager and Nasty Boy himself. Those charges are still pending. This was obviously a big talker. It was our number one story on the website, and I think every TV station in New England decided to come up here and steal it after that. But it certainly is an interesting story.
Yeah, I was talking with some friends about it because I just found it so odd and fascinating. And they were saying, like, the fact that given, you know, how many drugs are out there in New Hampshire and how much we don't know, like, what is out there on the streets, the fact that people are willing to drive up to a Burger King and just order marijuana from someone that they probably don't know and is, I guess it's not shocking, but I think it's,
you may need to get out more, Kathleen.
Fairly interesting.
It's a crazy world out there. But so, Trent, you say thousands and thousands of hits on this story?
More than. I'm sure millions of people have read this story, either through the union leader's original reporting or through all the copycats after that.
All right. Join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Again, the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. This week we have Trent Spinner, New Hampshire Union Leader, Kathleen Ronan, Associated Press, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. So we're going to turn to School Choice Week, which is what it was. And this week, it's a week when advocates for alternative education, tuition tax credits, vouchers, charter schools, homeschoolers, make a big push politically. It's a week when, Governor Sununu gave a speech at the Courier Gallery. We were both there, Kathleen. Did you hear anything that sounded like a clear policy commitment from him?
No. And I think that is the big question here on school choice. You know, we hear him talk about how parents, should have the ultimate say, whether they want to go to private school, public school, et cetera. But we've not I don't know what that means. Is it providing more money, you know, in the budget? Is it setting up some type of voucher school program? There has not really been clear policy laid out here.
All right, we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Stay with us.
This is NHPR. It's 9:39.
I'm Joshua Johnson. Next time on 1A, the Friday News Roundup.
Do I feel it works? Absolutely, I feel it works.
It's been a hectic week in Washington. What's been said, and what does it all mean?
If they started waterboarding, I swear to you, there's a whole bunch of us that would have them in court in a New York minute.
Waterboarding, border walls, and Venus and Serena Williams. Because there's more to life than politics on 1A's Friday News Roundup.
That's this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Mix of sun and clouds for most of New Hampshire today. Mostly cloudy with some snow likely from the mountains north. Windy statewide. High temperatures today. Lower 30s in the north, ranging lower 40s in the south. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners. And support also comes to us from UNH Cooperative Extension, partnering with the USDA to provide business and risk management workshops for New Hampshire farmers. More information at 603-787-6944. This is NHPR.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR's Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477 or by email at exchange@NHPR or on Facebook and Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, this week we have Transmitter New Hampshire Union leader Kathleen Ronan of the Associated Press, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Before the break, we were talking about School Choice Week, Governor Sununu's push in this direction, what we might expect. Why don't we take a listen to what he had to say? I asked him about this, what we might get out of his budget on this front at the event.
One thing that we are committed to is what we're talking about today. It's opening up the doors to school choice opportunities for all families, regardless of how much money you may make. Everybody needs to have the opportunity to provide the best path for their kids, and that's just going to be a focus. And whether it's providing more funding for charter schools, opening up options for homeschooling, looking at where the business tax credit comes into play in terms of funding some scholarships and options, all of those are pieces that come in that I think can provide better opportunities for the people in New Hampshire.
All right, that was Governor Sununu speaking after a speech at an education choice event. You know, most of the main kind of tools in the school choice arsenal kind of on the table there, but we don't really know exactly what we're going to get out of him yet.
No, not yet. And, you know, we are seeing a sea change both nationally and locally. Nationally, we have President Trump's education nominee, Betsy DeVos, is a big proponent of school choice. Here, Governor Sununu has nominated State Rep Frank Edelblue, who's homeschooled his kids, is also a big proponent of school choice. So I think there's clearly a sense that the focus is going to change a bit. You know, others have expressed concern, particularly Democrats, that this may be a sort of the beginning of siphoning funds away from public school. I think there's going to be a whole separate debate over the extent to which the state adequately funds secondary education. But yeah, right now it feels like the whole menu is sort of out there, and we'll see where the legislature and the governor decide to focus. But you know, you look at the changes represented by those two nominees at the national and state level, and it feels like the debate's going to be a little bit different for a while.
Well, it was interesting to hear one thing that the governor said in his speech. He talked about some of his own life experience. He talked about having experienced homeschooling his children. He talked about how they've attended public school, how they're now attending Catholic school. He's certainly sensitive to the criticism that of some that creating greater opportunity for educational choice will siphon resources away from public schools in New Hampshire. And he said, you know, I'm the first governor in 25 years who attended public schools in New Hampshire. Before that, I guess Governor Merrill would have been the last. And you know, he also attended public schools in Virginia as well. He's clearly looking to do something here.
I think so. And I think the one concrete proposal we do have before us is the so-called Croydon bill is going back through the legislature. And I know that both Frank Edelblue and Chris Sununu had expressed support for Croydon in that situation, just basically what the bill would do says that if you are in a district that doesn't provide a certain grade level, so in a lot of small towns, the district might only go up through fourth or fifth grade, that your school board could approve non-public schools to send students to. And this became an issue when the town of Croydon was sending some students to a Montessori school, and they wanted, you know, to use taxpayer dollars to do it. So I think that that bill is going to be kind of a vehicle for this debate over school choice. It is interesting because right now it only applies to districts that don't, you know, have maybe a public high school. So, you know, if you live in Concord, well, too bad, you know, you don't have the option of using tax dollars for private school. But if you live in Croydon or another small town, you might. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see that bill get amended, you know, quite a bit through the process. But that is at least one specific thing we can look at that expands this idea of school choice, and we'll probably see more through the budget.
Well, he mentioned expansion of perhaps the educational tax credit program, and you know, numbers that were reported by a colleague here at NHPR showed that donations, you know, per a report from the Department of Revenue, were up 77% over 2015, you know, totaling, you know, close to $400,000, which isn't a humongous amount of money, but that allows some parents to avail themselves of opportunities they wouldn't otherwise. And, you know, Governor Sununu said Waterville Valley, when he was running it, was a participant in that program.
Right. And just to remind people what that essentially says that businesses can make a tax-deductible donation to this scholarship program that hands out scholarships to low-income families to send their children to private schools.
Here's the one challenge, and I want to read this exact line from the Constitution because the Attorney General's office brought this up at this hearing about the Croydon bill. The New Hampshire State Constitution says no person shall ever be compelled to pay for the support of any schools of a sect or denomination. And so they say even if this Croydon bill passes, it's potentially unconstitutional, and it creates all kinds of other issues. So, you know, as much as there is debate, and this is not just, I mean, I think we are talking about it here as like a political debate in Concord, but think about the people in Croydon. This is a very small town. There are hundreds of people there, and they're putting their kids, if they have two options. They can either put their kids and follow the law as it's written now. They can send them for, I think it's 40 minutes away to the closest public school, or they can pay. They can pay for a Montessori school, and you can either decide if you're a parent, you can either decide to, you know, pay that yourself. But what the school board has said is we will pay to send our kids to this Montessori school, and there's currently no vehicle for them to do that.
Well, but I think it sets up this interesting you know, question though about, so if you happen to live in a town without a public high school, your parents can get help for you to go to a private school. But what if you want to go to a private school where you're in a town with a public high school? You can't get – it sets up this two-tiered system about who gets help paying for private schools. And I think, you know, I'm not arguing on one side or the other, but it's certainly an interesting way to kind of set up, you know, these two standards essentially based on where you live about whether or not you can have assistance going to a private school.
And that was one of the arguments that the Attorney General's office made, is that there's this equal protection issue, right? If people in Croydon get that help, but let's say your child is assigned to go to West High School and you just don't want that your child to go to West. Now what happens? You can sue the city of Manchester. You can sue the state because people in Croydon get one thing and people in Manchester don't get it.
All right, comment from Heidi on Facebook. She says, I'm disturbed by my nation and the state's movement towards, quote, school choice. It's a thinly veiled attempt to defund public schools. That's Heidi. Give us your comment at exchange@nhpr.org or at NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter, and of course always by the phone, 1-800-892-6477. You know, the context of these, you know, to some extent, these debates, you know, boil down to money and resources. And, you know, in 13 days, we're going to get the governor's budget. You know, I tried to get an answer out of him about what we might get on educational choice front. You know, he was talking about, you know, we're still moving the Lego pieces around, is how he put it. But, you know, there's some spending needs that are being spelled out. You know, prior to this budget, you know, it looks like the dairy bailout sort of got a bit of a haircut this week. But, you know, $2 million for that. You know, Dean, how significant is that?
On the dairy bill specifically? Well, it's interesting. You know, there's been a long debate about, you know, whether or not you should provide aid to a particular agricultural industry. There are people who argue that it's really, given the unique nature of running a dairy and the fact that you have to continue to feed and care for the cows regardless of what is going on, on the sort of the market for milk, that this is shrinking in our state and shrinking in the region, that this is something that needs to be helped along given issues with prices. So, I think there are, you know, there are arguments on both sides, but, my guess is that there will be some aid to struggling farmers, dairy farmers, whether it's the $2 million or some other figure. But there is an argument that this is kind of sort of a special, you know, with crops, you can just kind of, you know, not cultivate the crops, but you still, you know, once you're raising cows, you got to continue to raise and milk the cows.
And looking over the horizon towards other cost issues and, you know, in the educational realm, it'll be interesting to see. We have both debate over, you know, in school funding, both ends of the sort of implications of stabilization grant changes. You have, you know, towns with growing enrollment who, you know, lost money on their cap are going to have to pay for more. The state's going to have to come up with more money for those towns. And then you have, you know, towns with shrinking enrollment who are pushing to get money because they depend on, you know, the help they were getting. We have DCYF. It will be in the budget. It's going to be interesting to see how much money is plowed into that division for more staff training. You know, Lorraine Bartlett is out as leader. Perhaps a good time to spend more time from her family, as she put it, given the reporting out of there. Getting a grip on Medicaid spending is going to be a challenge.
Leave discussion, money for family leave.
I mean, budgets are tough, but, I mean, do you get the sense from hanging out at the State House, Kathleen, that Republicans are feeling sort of optimistic about this task, eager to see, you know, Governor Sununu kind of leading the way, or it's going to be politely accept his budget and then now we're going to get to work, sort of?
I'm not quite sure yet. I think that because he does tend to kind of speak in broad general terms, it's like very hard to know what this budget is going to look like. And so I think, it comes out in February. We don't have to get something till June. So there's definitely potential, you know, I don't think New Hampshire lawmakers are ever, no matter who the governor is, just going to let the governor write a budget and kind of go with it. Like, that's just not how people like, you know, Neil Kirk or Chuck Morse operate. And you obviously know a little bit more about the state's revenue picture as we go on. But I think Sununu himself is, you know, setting up some expectations that things are tight. You know, he had that press conference a couple weeks ago where he talked about trying to get some spending in the current budget under control. HHS, you know, they kind of have perpetual budget issues. He didn't institute a hiring freeze, but basically said, be careful and you have to get approval from me before you want to make state hires. So, you know, acknowledging that the existing budget is already tight, which means that the next budget is probably going to be kind of tight too, unless you suddenly have this explosion in revenues. So I'll be very interested to see what that budget looks like, first Republican budget we've seen in a dozen years. But I think that, as always, you know, the lawmakers are going to want to get in there and kind of fiddle around with it and make sure that their priorities are in just as much as the governor's
One thing that has happened between the governor and the legislature that hasn't gotten a great deal of attention, but I thought it was interesting in that it was essentially the governor's first kind of move out of the box upon being sworn in, was this: we're going to have a moratorium on new rules, we're going to order an evaluation of all current rules, and, you know, I expect to report in 90 days. And, you know, the next time the rules committee met, it was a polite or not so polite sort of like, we've got this, governor, thanks for your input.
I didn't think it was that polite at all. I thought it was pretty strongly worded, saying you're violating the rules here, that there is a joint commission on rules. What happens is if a department wants to propose a new rule, they have to take it to this joint legislative committee of House and Senate members, and they get to say yay or nay. We just did a lot of coverage about this committee when there was a discussion about a bobcat hunt in New Hampshire. And they got a lot of feedback, and they hold public hearings and then they vote. And they say, hey, governor, you have no right to tell us whether or not to approve or not approve of. And what was interesting was that this was Senator Reagan, who was a Republican in the Senate.
Well, and I think it's also this idea, I believe that the governor's directive said something to the effect of, you know, you can't adopt rules that aren't mandated by law. And JELCAR is certainly not a committee that is just allowing people to create rules when there's no need to create rules. You know, one of the recent things they dealt with was the, you know, we passed a bill saying that the Board of Medicine, the Board of Veterinary Medicine, they all have to come up with these rules for how doctors use the prescription drug monitoring program. That all goes through the legislative committee. And it's, you know, it's not something that the Board of Medicine just kind of made up. It's something they're mandated to do by law. So I think you do see the lawmakers getting a little bit up in arms.
I thought the governor's response was interesting, too. I mean, it was kind of a non-response. You know, when I saw clarification on, like, so what are you going to do about this letter? And it was sort of like, you know, got an email back from his office saying, you know, the governor, we're all working together, and essentially the governor appreciates this feedback.
Yeah, but the reality is the age-old institutional conflict of bureaucratic control, whether a chief executive, whether you're talking about a governor or a president, they're always looking for ways to bottleneck control the flow of bureaucratic activity. So, you know, it was not surprising to see the governor say, okay, for hiring and spending, you need to come to me, and we need to review these regulations. It's a way to exert your preferences over the process. So I'm not surprised to see a Republican in the state legislature push back, because this is an institutional control question, not just a partisan one. And it goes all the way back to, you know, Ronald Reagan in the early 1980s put in place regulatory clearance, where regulations coming out of the bureaucracy had to be channeled through the Office of Management and Budget, which is in the White House. So it's a means of bureaucratic control by chief executives. And so I'm not surprised to see members of either party push back from the legislature.
I mean, it's also a bit of political posturing, like we're going to sort of, you know,
sure.
make
right.
we're going
sure.
to rein
speaking,
in
absolutely.
We're going to rein
that's
in
part of the
government overreach, and you know,
discourse.
You get that message
sure.
out like
but
day
the
one
underlying
that's my message,
issue is
and that's not bad
control.
For the governor. So go ahead, Kathleen.
Oh yeah, I was also just going to say, I asked him in this press conference he did a couple weeks ago, you know, if he expected that departments with thousands and thousands of regulations, say maybe the health department, environmental services, you know, who's going to be doing this? He wants a report on every single regulation.
No, that struck
me as
a lot of work
within 90
well.
Days.
Like March 31st,
and I asked,
I think,
you know, yeah. Do you know who's going to be doing this? Do you anticipate providing overtime? You're talking about effectively a hiring freeze here, and our department's going to need to spend more money to comply with this. And he basically scoffed at the question and said, you know, if they can't figure out if their regulations are working or not in that time frame, then there's a bigger problem going on. So.
All right.
You know, and so far, you know, the departments have not, obviously it's a new governor, they're not so keen to, you know, butt heads right away. And as far as I know, you know, outwardly the departments have said, you know, we'll undertake this exercise and we're looking forward to, you know, making sure we're operating efficiently. So we'll see how comprehensive those reports are in 90 days.
All right, we're almost out of time. I want to say to all those people who are on the phone wanting to talk about school choice, the exchange will be covering school choice explicitly next Wednesday. So hold your fire until then and join the exchange next Wednesday for that show. We're almost out of time. What's everyone going to be looking at in the near term, Trent?
I would, if you're interested in the Bob Evans case, which we led this show with, I would definitely pick up the Sunday News. We're going to be coming back on the story, answering a lot of unanswered questions, and really digging into it a lot deeper. So if you're interested in that story, pick up a copy of the Sunday News.
Kathleen?
Frank Edelblue, the education commissioner nominee, will have a public hearing next Tuesday at 1 at the State House. So if people have stuff to say, they should come to that as well.
Yeah, that's the one I'm interested in following as well. It'll be a good window into how the whole education debate is going to shape up in the state. Plus, also watching all the activity at the national level as well, with the new president, new members of Congress.
And the New Hampshire GOP will have a new chairman as of
that's
tomorrow.
Right.
Looks to be Jeanie Forrester. One big outstanding question is, will they move to give her a salary, which would be setting new precedent for that party? All right, everybody, have a good weekend. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Josh Rogers. Thanks to our guests, Trent Spinner, New Hampshire Union leader Kathleen Ronan, Associated Press, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search iTunes or Google Play for NHPR Exchange.
Next week on The Exchange, after the annual March for Life in Washington, we ask how Americans today feel about abortion. Then driving through the complicated landscape of auto insurance and ideas for reform. And later, school choice gets high marks from the White House and the State House, but opponents are already gearing up. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 7 p.m. on NHPR.
Next at 10 o'clock on NHPR. We'll have a mix of sun and clouds for most of New Hampshire today. Mostly cloudy with some snow likely from the mountains north. Windy statewide. High temperatures today, lower 30s. In northern New Hampshire ranging lower 40s in the south. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners. And support also comes to us from Bensonwood. Building energy-efficient, high-performance homes and commercial structures in New Hampshire, throughout New England, and across America since 1973. Bensonwood.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.